Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At least for today, investors appear to have shrugged off the recent ratings downgrade of France and other Eurozone countries. And now there is a downgrade for the bailout fund itself. So if everybody keeps getting downgraded from AAA, maybe subpar is the new normal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for January 16th. Today was the first trading day since rating agency Standard & Poor's stripped France of its AAA designation. Several other European countries were downgraded on Friday as well. And today, S&P said it has also cut the rating on the Eurozone's rescue fund. But all in all, the reaction from Europe, with U.S. markets on holiday, was meh. Our European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard joins us now from London to talk about what that reaction might signal. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Tess.
So European markets ended the day slightly higher, the euro pretty much unchanged against the dollar. Why? Why has the response to these downgrades been so muted?
Well, this is going to sound odd, but one reason could be that the US markets were closed today, since this is a European problem. But very often, this is what happens when Wall Street is closed. European markets do tread water. They seem to need the bigger US markets to tell them what to do. But anyway, this move by S&P was hardly a surprise. S&P had warned these countries, including France, that they could face a downgrade. So
Right. You
could argue a downgrade was already in the price.
This certainly can't mean that the downgrades don't matter, does it? I mean,
no.
You know, the U.S. lost its AAA crown and hasn't made a huge difference to us here. Does that mean it's the same for Europe?
No, I think it matters a lot more here. It matters in France and could have political repercussions. President Sarkozy faces elections in April and May. And the AAA has been very important to him. He's been treating it almost like a virility symbol. He said last year, if we lose the AAA, I'm finished.
Oh.
France takes these symbols very seriously. This is undoubtedly a blow to national pride. France's national emblem, after all, is a cockerel, and there's not much to strut and crow about in a downgrade.
Indeed. Stephen, what about the wider European picture? Could the downgrade make it more difficult to resolve the Eurozone debt crisis?
Yes, and here's the difference between Europe and the US, which, as you say, brushed off its downgrade. The dollar is still the world's number one reserve currency, still seen as a safe haven in troubled times. Investors still prepared to lend vast sums to the US, and that keeps US borrowing costs down. The Eurozone is different. It's 17 different countries. There are some doubts about whether their currency, the euro, will survive the current crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So these downgrades are likely to mean it'll be a little more difficult for the countries concerned to borrow. And it's a vote of no confidence in the way this crisis has been handled. So although the market reaction has been muted, this definitely isn't good news.
Along with the downgrades, we also learned Friday that the Greek debt talks have collapsed. How big a deal is that?
Potentially a bigger deal than the downgrades. I mean, these talks were aimed at easing Greece's debt burden by writing a lot of it off in an orderly fashion. Now, the banks that lent money to Greece are taking part in the negotiations, but they were asked to take a bigger hit than they expected, and they stormed out of the meeting on Friday. Now, they're meeting again on Wednesday. They're going to kiss and make up, but the clock is ticking. Greece has got to borrow $17, $18 billion by March the 20th, and it won't be able to unless these debt talks succeed. Martina Stivas, a Greek journalist with the Wall Street Journal, thinks Greece is running out of time and may not make it.
Votes have to be taken. Laws have to be changed. Things have to happen in the market. Decisions have to be made by euro area leaders. And all these things have to happen in 46 working days. Now, that's not a long time.
She believes Greece could default by accident, and a Greek default would take this crisis to a whole new level of danger. We certainly wouldn't be talking about muted market reactions then.
All right, an ever-evolving story over in Europe. Marketplace's Stephen Beard joining us from London. Thank you so much.
Okay, Tess.
Wall Street was closed for the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, so we will have details from the rest of the globe when we do the numbers. The House of Representatives is back to work tomorrow after a three-week holiday break. The Senate's not in session until next week. Nobody expects much lawmaking this year. Election politics will only add to the partisan gridlock in Washington. But one priority for some congressional leaders is to extend the payroll tax reduction, now set to expire at the end of February. Since that is likely to be one of the few pieces of legislation to make it to the president's desk this year, businesses are lobbying lawmakers to attach a whole lot of other tax breaks to it. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that story.
At midnight on New Year's Eve, a long list of federal tax reductions for businesses expired. They included breaks for investments in factory equipment and a tax credit for research and experimentation. It's a total of 57 tax breaks in all. Syracuse University professor Leonard Berman says they're temporary because no one successfully made the case for making them permanent.
A lot of them really don't make sense as policy, but the practice has been in the past that every year or 2 years or whenever they come up, they just get extended because even though they're kind of dumb, they represent unwarranted government interference in particular industries, they've got really strong constituencies behind them.
This year, those constituencies are trying to get the tax break extensions attached to the payroll tax reduction bill. But the breaks for businesses are getting extra scrutiny because each costs the government revenue. Berman says even those that do make it on board the only train leaving the station likely won't be signed until late February at the earliest. And that delay, he says, makes many of them ineffective because businesses have to make investment decisions before then.
You're not entirely sure you're going to get the credit, which means that you're more likely to just do things you would have done anyway, and then you get a giant tax credit on top of that. That's wasting tax money and producing no effect on behavior.
Berman says short-term business tax breaks should be limited to 3 times, and then Congress should be required to either make them permanent or drop them entirely. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So that payroll tax will likely be a defining issue this year in Congress. Another one? Well, jobs, more specifically job creation. The latest report out of the Labor Department showed companies added 200,000 jobs in December. The unemployment rate ticked down to 8.5%. But that is an average, and there are still communities where the rate is much, much higher, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
African-American unemployment tops 15%, more than double the rate for whites. So on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, what would the civil rights leader make of the economic state of Black America? I asked Margaret Sims of the Urban Institute.
I think in some ways he would find himself where he was around the time he was assassinated, when he was organizing a poor people's campaign.
Sims says the African-American middle class has grown significantly since 1968.
But if we look at the conditions within African-American communities, we find that many people have been left behind.
Sims says the recession hit minorities particularly hard. Many work in low-skilled fields where layoffs were severe. That's construction and manufacturing for Black men, retail for Black women. And now they're having a tougher time than whites getting back to work.
It's the old cliche, last hired, first fired. Only in this case, as we come into the recovery, it's first fired, last hired.
And in a disturbing trend, African-American unemployment actually started rising again late last year. Rutgers economist William Rogers says that's partly because cash-strapped state and local governments are slashing jobs, teachers, caseworkers, administrators.
Since African-Americans, particularly African-American women, are heavily concentrated in the public sector, they're facing, and their communities are facing a double whammy.
Rogers says not only are middle-class government jobs with pensions and health benefits evaporating, government support services that many depend on are being cut. And communities of color are fighting back through labor unions, civil rights groups, and under the Occupy Wall Street umbrella. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of Occupy Wall Street, police sweeps have closed many of their camps in a growing number of cities, among them New York, Oakland, and here in Los Angeles. But the movement is still active. Demonstrations and marches were held around the country today to mark Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. An Occupy Congress protest is planned for tomorrow, and Occupy Wall Street is already gearing up for spring. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer checked in with the movement to see how it's weathering the winter.
One of the last big city Occupy encampments is here in Washington, D.C. Actually, there are two Occupy camps. 29-year-old Sarah Anderson sits in the information tent at the camp in Washington's McPherson Square. It's only a couple of blocks from the White House. She says some of her fellow occupiers still want all meetings held outside at the camp. But
you can't concentrate real good when you're freezing your butt off.
Anderson says some Occupy D.C. meetings are held in a nearby McDonald's. Occupy activists in other cities have official indoor digs. Atlanta occupiers have set up shop in a homeless shelter. Occupy Wall Street has an actual office in Lower Manhattan. Some occupiers say that's selling out, becoming too corporate. But Occupy Wall Street spokesman Ed Needham says it's just a matter of logistics.
The simple fact of the matter is that we need a place to work that's indoors, where we can have meetings and do the work that we have to do every day.
Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane has been studying the movement. She says location doesn't matter. She compares it to other social movements that didn't have a home. There was no Zuccotti Park for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
You know, a lot of the early civil rights organizing happened in churches, but it was knitted together by the power of the leadership. So I don't think Occupy Wall Street is going to die a slow death if they end up in an office space.
But there will still be growing pains over other steps the movement is taking, like hiring an accountant. Occupy spokesman Ed Needham says it's another routine chore on the path to permanence. But some activists in Washington think Occupy is getting mired in capitalist corruption. Take donations. 23-year-old Andrew Beal says the movement should only accept donations of food and supplies and reject cash.
Money itself is the root of all the problems that the Occupy movement is fighting against. The old adage that money is the root of all evil, I think that's absolutely true.
Evil or not, the Occupy accountant may not have much cash to count. Donations have slowed to a trickle. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Today we continue a series of commentaries we're calling My Life is True. It's a look at folks living at the hard edge of the economy. Oakland resident Alejandra Bautista Landon was once a promising undergrad with dreams of law school. Then she made a decision that would forever change her life.
I had way too much going on. I was in a folkloric dance troupe, working at Rite Aid, and manning a health hotline. I thought lots of extracurriculars would get me into a good law school. But my grades started to suffer. I was put on academic probation, and my financial aid was suspended. I wasn't able to ask for help. I wanted to fix my problems, secretly, without disappointing anybody. So I robbed a bank. I still ask myself how I got the idea. I was desperate. I thought, no one will know. I'll never speak of it. It'll be just one time, and I'll just move forward. I walked in and gave the teller a note. Some of what you see in the movies is true. Tellers are supposed to acquiesce to whatever you ask. I got a few $1,000s, and it all went to pay for school. I thought, let me just try this one more time so I can pay off a little more debt. It didn't work. A judge sentenced me to 30 months in prison. I put on a brave face, but I was frightened. When I got out, I was assigned to a halfway house near Lake Merritt. I loved walking around the lake and just looking at people. It made me feel normal again. One day I saw a guy from the halfway house wearing a polo shirt that said, Healthy Oakland. He said the place helps people get back on their feet, get health insurance, see a doctor, or find a place to live. I started volunteering there. After a month, they offered me a job. I help whomever comes in. Some are homeless, others are just out of prison. I tell them that I was there too. They always say, You don't look like you were in prison. I say, You don't either. We're seeing more professionals now who can't afford health insurance. And lots of long-term unemployed. Our waiting area is always full. Most of the day I sit down with folks. I listen to what's going on with them and try to help. It's an unbelievable privilege to have someone trust me enough to say they need help, the kind of help I once needed but couldn't ask for.
Alejandra's story comes to us from My Life is True, a reporting project of the New America Foundation. Tell us what you think. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. Coming up, how the price of something changes the way you buy.
Anytime a number pops into your mind, it influences your judgment. So you think a football player has made more tackles in a year if their jersey number is 97 than if it's 27.
The science of price anchoring. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed due to the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. Overseas, the markets reacted to Friday's announcement about the Standard & Poor's downgrades we mentioned. Investors, as we said, seemed to say, so what, to the announcement. The CAC 40 in Paris gained nearly 0.9%. Frankfurt's DAX rose nearly 1.3%. And London's FTSE kicked up 0.3%. The euro was also up about 0.2%, an improvement over its drop to a 17-month low against the dollar on Friday. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Markets reopen on Wall Street after Martin Luther King Day. In Washington, the Federal Reserve releases its selected weekly interest rates. And President Obama meets with Jordan's King Abdullah II to discuss the Middle East peace process. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Drought and war in the Horn of Africa have left a wide swath of the population there homeless and hungry. The United Nations says some 11 million people need aid to survive. Many of those displaced have headed to Kenya, which itself has deep economic problems. But for all the international aid Kenya has received over the last 30 years, life expectancy there has actually shortened and poverty rates are unchanged. Mary Stuckey reports.
13 years ago, an American tourist named Mary Steiner arrived here on the shores of Lake Victoria in southwestern Kenya. What she found would change her life and life for thousands of people here.
I met with the women's group, women who lost 7 of their 8 children. I listened. They said that they wanted health. There are too many women dying. We want it to stop.
So Steiner partnered with Elijah Omolo, a Kenyan who'd grown up here. Together, they started a non-governmental organization, or NGO, to address the dire needs in this area of Kenya. Omolo came up with the name, Give Us Wings.
He said, what we need is someone to give us wings. People are smart. People know what's important to them.
The people wanted medical care, so Steiner went back to the U.S. and raised enough money to build what's now the Nyoga Medical Clinic. The clinic serves more than 15,000 people in a region rife with malaria and AIDS. Next, they built an adult literacy school and hired a teacher.
The first one is...
On my visit, about 20 women were studying here. Many have brought their small children to school with them. Some women have gone on to high school and university. Milka Ajaimo says she wants to be a teacher.
We are dreaming something which is changing our life. We are saying English. We are somebody.
An estimated 4 to 7,000 NGOs work in Kenya, despite all the organizations and money. Overall, Kenyans have seen very little improvement in their lives. Elia Zulu is executive director of the African Institute for Development Policy, a think tank based in Nairobi.
The U.S. NGOs, which come with their huge overheads, you still see that quite a bit of that money is not ending up to the people who need to use it. We need to keep emphasizing that they can account for each and every penny.
Zulu says donors should demand to see an independent audit and the tax form 990 that NGOs have to provide under U.S. tax law. Another rule of thumb, give money, not things. For every dollar spent shipping food to Africa, $2 is spent in transport. And donors should look for hard evidence that programs are working. Most experts agree that donors should look for NGOs that collaborate with each other, stay long enough to solve problems, and then move on. Fred Alendo is with the National Council of NGOs, an independent group that monitors NGOs in Kenya. Alendo says donors should support NGOs that work closely with Kenyans.
The idea is to have them own the process so that they are able to build the capacity of the community to solve their own problem.
Back in the village, Mary Steiner says her NGO is getting ready to leave the community near Lake Victoria.
There are many people who have better health care. There are people who have better education. There are people who believe in their own power. They're moving forward on their own.
Near Lake Victoria, I'm Mary Stuckey for Marketplace.
Why do we do the smart and not so smart things we all do with our money? Well, some of it is because our emotions drive us to bad spending decisions. Some of it is hardwiring. One of those hardwires is something called price anchoring. It happens every single day in your decision-making process, including the decisions you make about how you're going to dole out your precious dollars. Nick Epley teaches behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you kind of describe for us in your own words this idea of anchoring and how we do it in our everyday lives?
It's actually simple. It's anytime a number pops into your mind, it influences your judgment. So you think a football player has made more tackles in a year if their jersey number is 97.
Really?
Than if it's 27, yeah. Or a car mechanic. If you come into the mechanic's shop and you say, do you think this will cost more or less than $1,000? They'll estimate that it'll cost less money than if you ask, do you think this will cost more or less than $5,000?
Huh.
So it shows up in so many places, it's all over the map. If I ask you, is Mount Everest taller or shorter than 50,000 feet? What do you think, Tess? How tall is Mount Everest?
Oh, geez, I should really know this. Less than?
Less than 50,000. Okay,
yeah.
How tall is Mount Everest?
30? 28?
It's pretty close. So
yeah.
It's 29,035 feet. If I'd ask you, though, is Mount Everest taller or shorter than 5,000 feet, chances are you'd have given a much lower estimate.
Well, no, because I lived in Oregon, so I know that Mount Hood is 11,000 feet, and I know Mount Everest is taller than Mount Hood.
That offset the 50,000-foot anchor just a little bit.
Yes.
You were using
yes,
a slightly
indeed.
Different anchor, yeah.
In fact, I anchor everything to what I know about Mount Hood.
Is that right? All things?
Yes. Everything in life.
How much is in your bank account? It must be less than 11,000. Must be more.
Certainly
Who
less.
Knows?
Than... I am an anchor woman.
You are. That's right. There you go.
All right. So how do companies and Madison Avenue use this to sell us on products and things?
Well, I don't know the exact details because I'm not in Madison Avenue.
Right.
But I do know how it can affect consumers. There's a really neat study by Brian Wansink, a researcher at Cornell University. He went into a grocery store and put up different advertisements for Snickers bars. And in one condition, the advertisement said, buy some for your freezer. Right? In the other condition, it said, buy 18 for your freezer. And people bought considerably more when they were encouraged to buy 18 for their freezer than when they were encouraged to buy some.
So what is happening in our brains there?
Well, a couple things are happening. One is that the decisions that we make are made online, right? So when you go into a grocery store, if you've got a list, you kind of know what you're going to buy, but then a lot of decisions you make on the fly. How many Snickers bars do you really need? Well, I don't know. And the way we make things up on the fly are by attending carefully to numbers that are out there, and sometimes those numbers can be arbitrary, like buying 18 Snickers bars for your freezer.
So is this something that we can use as consumers to affect our own behavior?
Well, it's a kind of phenomena that you need to be cognizant of. You need to be paying careful attention to the anchors that are relevant. like the amount of money that you have to spend is relevant for whether something is affordable or not. So the cost of a Toyota Camry last year is relevant for the cost of a Toyota Camry this year, if mm-hmm. you're trying to figure out what that is. Or the close of the stock market yesterday is very relevant for the close of the stock market today. So lots of anchors out there in the world are relevant. What we need to be on guard for are the irrelevant ones. What you pay on your credit card balance isn't a function of what the credit card company tells you is the minimum amount you could pay. It's a function of how much can you afford to pay on this. Or even in a salary negotiation, it's been shown that the opening salary offer matters a lot for the eventual price that you get at the end of the negotiation. It's been shown to influence judges' decisions of the sentence that should be awarded to somebody. So the prosecutor's suggested sentence influences the judge's beliefs about the length of a sentence.
You know, I just have this picture going through my head from that movie, A Beautiful Mind, where all those numbers and facts and figures were floating in and out on the screen. And I guess that's what we are all going through, perhaps not quite as smart as that, but, you know, on a daily basis, we are surrounded by numbers and they are affecting us.
They are. I think the bigger problem is, unlike in A Beautiful Mind, where there are lots and lots and lots of different numbers and broad ranges that you might consider for any given problem, the problem that we have as human beings, normal human beings, is that we tend to consider one number, one anchor value. And that's the problem we get into, not considering too many. It's just that we consider one, the one that's easiest to bring to mind sometimes.
Nick Epley is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Thanks for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, those boots were made for walking and apparently hacking. The online shoe giant Zappos notified some 24 million customers yesterday that its site had been hacked. The company, which is owned by Amazon, said credit card numbers weren't compromised, but personal information, including names, addresses, phone numbers, and emails, may have been accessed. It urged customers to change their passwords on the site. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed for the holiday today. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Next time on this program, remember Mr. Rogers' factory tours?
I'd like to show you some people making crayons. Let's come along. I have a film of it here.
We'll ask whatever happened to some of those factories. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.